Today's episode is an epic love fest for two of the greatest science fiction magazines ever published, Epic Illustrated and Heavy Metal. Like an entire generation of readers, Dwight and Swain became huge fans of Epic and Metal Hurlant back in the mid-80s. The most revered science fiction, fantasy, and comic book storytellers of all time were featured in their hallowed pages, such as Mobius, Michael Moorcock, Jim Starlin, Wendy Penny, Boris Vallejo, Luis Royal, John J. Muth, Richard Corbin, Joe Duffy, Inky Bilal, Marie Severin, Jeffrey Catherine Jones, H.R. Giger, Simon Beasley, Pepe Moreno, Harlan Ellison, the Hildebrandt Brothers, and many, many more. In the conversation, Dwight and Swain give their first impressions of the magazines, name check their favorite artist from that era, and of course, discuss the 1981 Heavy Metal movie, as well as a one-time rumored David Fincher and James Cameron produced sequel. We at Sidebar Forever are of the opinion that Epic Illustrated and Heavy Metal closed the gap between amazing book cover paintings and amazing comic book art. They were tastemakers and showed the world what great fantasy stories could and should be. And by the way, four decades later, Heavy Metal magazine is still being published. As always, thanks for listening to the podcast. And for more episodes of the show, make sure to visit us at sidebarforever.com or wherever you get your podcast.
Good morning, Dr. Silberman. How's the knee?
Did you just have a brain fart?
I know Taekwondo.
Stop eating my sesame cake.
You're killing me, Smalls.
Fuck with me, and we'll see who shits on the sidewalk.
Come quietly, or there will be trouble.
Clearly, I wasn't talking to you, big titties. You cherub-looking motherfucker.
While you were still learning how to spell your name, I was being trained to conquer galaxies.
The real question is, what are those?
My name is Swain Hunt.
My name is Dwight Clark.
And we are two of the hosts of Sidebar Forever. Our third host, Adrian Johnson, is not with us today.
Right.
But we got this.
We got this.
The episode is entitled Epic Metal, and it's going to be a complete and totally epic, love fest for two of the greatest science fantasy magazines that have ever been published, Epic Illustrated and Heavy Metal Magazine.
Yep. Metal Hurlant.
Yeah. Well, not quite, and we'll get into that.
Exactly. No, it's not the same.
Not quite. Yeah, we'll get into that.
It's true, right?
Dwight and I are both huge fans of Epic Illustrated and Heavy Metal.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy Metal is definitely right in Dwight's wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Epic was definitely in my wheelhouse because it was kind of like Heavy Metal, but it was also kind of like American Comics in a way. But we became big fans of it when both of these premiered in the 70s and 80s. And and Heavy Metal Magazine is still being published today on their website. I think it's heavymetalmedia.com, if I'm not mistaken. But for anyone who doesn't know, you know, Epic Illustrated ran from 1980 to 1986. I think it was 34 issues.
Yep, 34 issues.
They launched an offshoot called Epic Comics in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, it was edited by Archie Goodwin for 80 or 90% of the time.
Right.
Archie Goodwin was the editor of it. And Epic Illustrated was, it was a comic anthology series, although mostly non-superhero, right, D?
Yeah, mostly non-superhero. I mean, it was their swing at the door, swing at the fences of trying to appropriate an audience that was already going towards heavy metal. You know, and it was a more mature audience they were looking for, because they saw that a lot of cases, their audience was getting older, so were their needs in storytelling, you know, and they wanted to you know, garner a broader audience way beyond the general ages of, you know, comics and superheroes.
Right. I didn't even think about that, but that makes perfect sense, and that's something to keep in mind when we talk about you know, our thoughts on, you know, when it's, you know, when Epic Illustrated sprang, you know, some years after heavy metal and so on and so forth. But yeah, comic anthology series, deluxe magazine format, very slick, very produced. In most cases, like painterly comics. Some cases black and white. In some cases, it was, you know, a mix of the two. But all of the things that, that Dee had to say was definitely there. Epic, if you look at the cover and the logo for Epic, Epic always came off to me like Time Magazine for fantasy adventure nerds.
I didn't think about that. Yeah.
You know, four letters in the name, four letters in the name Time. You know, very singular, easy to, you know, pick out. Okay, Epic. You know, it says everything in that one word.
Right.
Some of the contributors to Epic Magazine, the regular comics contributors, you know, guys and gals who had worked in mainstream American comics would be Jim Starlin, Mike Kaluta, Barry Windsor-Smith, Joe Duffy, John Byrne, Terry Austin, Stephen Bissett, Dean Motter, Charles Vess, and Denny O'Neill, and then others who were more outside of comics. And we'll talk some more about these folks too, but Boris Vallejo, Frank Frazetta, the Hildebrandt brothers, Trina Robbins, the recently departed Richard Corbin,
Tim Conrad, Bill Sienkiewicz.
Bill Sienkiewicz was
in Epic,
Yeah, okay, you're right. I've forgotten about that. I had forgotten about that.
I'll be your slow dancer, dancer for money.
Money. Rick Veitch, Kent Williams, Pepe Moreno.
Yeah, man.
Dave Sim. Tons of great artists and storytellers.
Then there's John Byrne. I'm just kidding.
Oh, my goodness. Shots fired.
No, man. I mean, it was out of all the stories that were I guess you say gentrified as being non-comic oriented stories.
Yeah.
He brought the one comic books oriented story the one superhero oriented story into, I mean, arguably superhero oriented with the Last Galactus story.
The Last Galactus, yeah.
You know, into the fray, into the mix. So it just seemed like it was kind of like it, which I didn't mind at the time as a teenager. I was like, wow, yeah, I love some John Byrne and I love some John Byrne, and you know I love Galactus, you know, and the new Herald he had at the time, which was Nova, Frankie something Adams something, she was cool, you know, but you could easily see, okay, this wasn't going to be any kind of real serious epic, and the conclusion was kind of less than satisfying for me, but that's a whole nother story.
No. I was actually thinking about that when I wrote his name down, The Last Galactus story. And it was kind of shoehorned in. Like, it was almost like, you know, you're having a nice Italian dinner and then somebody brings, like, egg noodles or sushi or Brazilian chicken wings. And you're like, what are you doing, dog?
How'd they get here, right?
How does this? This has nothing to do with that.
Right.
Heavy Metal was first published in 1977, April of 77, and as mentioned before, it's still going now. I think Tim Seeley is the editor-in-chief of Heavy Metal magazine. Started by a guy named Leonard Mogul.
Okay.
And from what I can tell, so what happened was is Leonard Mogul worked for National Lampoon.
Okay.
Mogul was in France launching a French version of National Lampoon magazine.
Okay.
When he discovered Mittal Herlan, which had started, which was, had been published a few years prior to that, by Jean Giraud, aka Mobius, as well as Philippe Drouillet, and Jean Dionnet, I think is how they're pronounced. I know I'm screwing those up, but I think our friend Dan Christensen can probably correct my all my pronunciations.
Right, that's a nice attempt at French. I like it, man. It sounded good to me. Authentic.
So, but he. He encountered Mittal Herlan and then went back to America and started publishing an American version of it called Heavy Metal. So he was doing Heavy Metal and they were doing Mittal Herlan in France. And then eventually Mittal Herlan, you know, they shut their doors. But same thing. Featured a lot of European artists at first. Guido Crepax. Milo Manara, Anki Bilal, of course Mobius, and then they started introducing more American artists like Richard Corbin, Stephen Bissett, Arthur Sadam, Gray Morrow, Walt Simonson, Olivia DeBernardinis, Steranko, Howard Chaykin, Jeff Jones or Jeffrey Catherine Jones, Daniel Torres, John Workman, and even Andy Kubert worked, did some lettering work for Heavy Metal.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. In one of the issues that I pulled out from the basement, Kubert's name is on there as a he did some lettering design.
Nice.
But Deeks, let's talk a little bit about, man, our first encounters with these magazines and with these publications and kind of how they hit us as young comic fans who clearly had an interest in things, you know, beyond the superhero fair that we found in, you know, in
right,
you know, in most American comics.
Right. Well, for me, I see the first time I saw a either one of them, first time I saw Heavy Metal be first before I saw Epic, I saw it probably on the top shelf of barely in reach for my little hands, my little grubby hands. Not really. It wasn't kind of that high up, but it was probably in the middle shelf of Oxford Bookstore, where you had some of the more mature comics.
Okay.
And yeah, and it was it got my attention because it had, I think the first cover I ever saw was the cover with, it was like a Droulet image, I think it was, because it's very graphic-y, and it had, like, you know, that very nice penmanship, that you know, it's beyond penmanship, it's just inking was just very frenetic and very, 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 very graphic, and it drew you in. And you know, so I reached for it, and I think I knew what it said. It said adult illustrated, that it wasn't quite meant for me, but I still endeavored to go for it anyway, and it actually wasn't that bad. Once you open up and start looking at it, it was stuff that, you know, we weren't participating in yet, perhaps, in some of the parts of the pages. But it was very it felt like a command. It's like almost like, how can I say it? It was somewhat of a religious experience, in that you felt like you were reading something that was, that had a great deal of gravitas and history to it. Like you knew when you read this stuff, it was like, wow, this was like, did this really take place? What story is this from? You know, is this like a real documented point of history that you can trace back with? And of course it wasn't, but it felt like it was like real and virile. And not like comics at all. I mean, comics felt real enough as they were, but you knew it was an escapist thing, you know? You knew that,
right,
that comics were there in a serialized fashion, and that you even then you expected it to go on forever, because that's what they did. You know, the next adventure of Spider-Man, next adventure of the X-Men, next adventure of Captain America, so on and so forth. You knew that you pick it up and it would be a continuation of what was happening already. With this stuff, it could fall off the deep end at any point in time. With this stuff, it was, you know, the anthologies could go, you know, any direction that they wanted to go at that point in time. There was no guarantee that it would continue. Like, if Droulet had a story he wanted to tell, or one of my favorites of all time, which I didn't get a chance to see until probably around 85 or 86. I'm talking about my man, Serpieri.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, you had no idea where that story was going. All you knew was a very attractive woman on there. There were some alien-looking creatures that were very organic, doing things to her that you wish you could do to a woman at that time, and she probably weren't doing. So, I'm just being honest. So it was a thing wherein, you know, those stories were, they're more adult, man. There was more not content for humanity, but there was more a sense of peril. And that at any point in time, things could go wrong, and that you were going on for that ride, you know? So.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because that's exactly what I was thinking, too, that Heavy Metal, as a forerunner to Epic Illustrated, struck me the same way. I'm certain, I'm positive, and I mentioned Don Hillsman on one of our last episodes. I'm certain I read and was exposed to, like, up close where I could read and borrow issues from him.
Right.
Heavy Metal magazine from Don.
Right.
And like you said, you know, the stories were wilder, more psychedelic and otherworldly. And there was a sense of foreboding or peril, like you said, where, you know, you're reading Captain America and Batman and Wonder Woman and the Avengers and X-Men and Justice League, and you know nothing too terrible is ever going to happen to these people.
Right.
But a character in Heavy Metal magazine, and, you know, you may have just been introduced to that character two or three pages before.
Right.
Could die at the end of the story. Or their child could die.
Yeah.
You know, or their romantic partner could die or whatever. So, yeah, you're exactly right with that. And like I said, I'm pretty sure it was Don who probably showed me that stuff. And it was, I mean, it was like, you know, Penthouse Forum or, you know, Wee Magazine or Blacktail or, any, you know, any of that stuff.
Right.
You know, with some of the nudity. But it was definitely, like you said, man, it was more mature, more adult stories, more extreme violence. And just definitely a departure, like, you know, this isn't superhero fare. This is something else.
Yeah. I mean, and the narratives were stronger too, dude. I mean, you know, they have, I mean, like I was saying in some of the notes I sent you, it's like, to me, you can see the similarities and the departures between the epic and heavy metal, where in heavy metal was more, like, you could tell the history behind the people that were doing the work. It was always, you know, it always had some kind of sense of religiosity to it. Or some kind of, you know, kingdoms or majestic nature that, you know, and it never felt like you were, it always felt like you're taking a trip someplace that you had never, that you've never been before. It was a welcome departure from the comics that you were reading on a regular basis.
Yeah. The 80s and the 90s, and again, Epic ran for 6 years in the 80s, and Heavy Metal started in 1977 and started before that, but the 80s was, and really part of the 90s, were really a magical time for fantastic storytelling. I remember the Atlanta Fantasy Fair here.
Yes.
You know, and meeting, you know, tons of great painters, Dave Dorman and Ted Bunthanacket, and Olivia may have come down 1 year. I'm trying to think of some of the other artists, Tim Bradstreet.
Yeah, man.
You know, it was just a really magical time, and so
I met Michael Whelan there, man, at the Dunphy Hotel, man. You know.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that.
Yeah, man. Yeah, when I met him at the, you met him for the second time, I guess you could say, or maybe a third time, perhaps at the, at Spectrum. I let him know that, you know, he was a part of my DNA.
Yeah, truly, he truly was. But this was the age of the graphic novel. You know, they call anything a graphic novel, but this is the age of the graphic novel. So, A Contract with God, you know, Will Eisner's book, came out in 78. And then I think the first Marvel official original graphic novels came out in like 82, and they ran for about a decade. The first one was The Death of Captain Marvel. So, and even one of the issues that I pulled out of the my boxes, the second page in the issue is an ad for
Death of Captain Marvel,
X-Men graphic novel by Brent Anderson and Chris Claremont, God Loves, Man Kills.
Right, right. that was great too. Yeah. That was awesome, man.
So it was just a lot, man. But my suspicion, let me ask you this. Do you know how Epic Illustrated was launched? Do you know anything about its background? I have, you know, my suspicions and my you know, but it's all, you know, conjecture on my part.
Yeah, no, I suspect, because we give credit to Archie Goodwin for taking the mantle, but it was first started by, I think his name is Rick Marshall.
Rick Marshall, yeah.
And then Marshall kind of gave over to the editorial ideal over to Archie, and he took it over. And I suspect it was probably a thing where they saw a changing landscape, probably going to conventions and stuff and seeing who was there and who was there as far as the older the audience was getting. And I suspect it was just out of the need to evolve, which is weird because I never thought that that Marvel would be that close to understanding, and that's not a slap in the face or I'm saying Marvel was never on the cusp of being, huh?
I said, yeah, you're saying it's not a dig, I guess.
It's not a dig, but I just think that they, you know, I think that they, to take such a bold stance and say, hey, what are they doing in the European markets? Let's look at that stuff. This stuff is on the newsstands. It's jazzy. It's got some potential. Let's try and do our version of that. And what leads me to that assumption is the fact that they look at the first cover is of The Seven Romans, done by Frank Frazetta.
Yes.
You know, and still, that shit still, like,
that shit is, that shit bangs, yo. That shit slaps so hard.
It really does, woo! Man. It still bangs the hell out of so many different artists today, to this day, man. It's still,
yeah,
like, cripples some careers, man. That's how good this shit is, man.
Frank Frazetta had all the hot shit.
He really did, man.
All the hot shit. Yeah, he was just like, okay, look, I'm taking all the hot shit. I'm not leaving nothing for anybody.
That's it. That's it, man. And everybody else that came after him, man, had a duplicate or do better than Frank, man. And I'd say some came pretty close, but they just couldn't do what Frank did for that first cover for me, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. My suspicions are line up pretty much with yours. I would imagine, so, you know, conventions, by 1980, when Epic Illustrated started, you know, heavy metal had been being published for 3 years.
Mm.
And conventions, comic conventions, as formal things, you know, it started in the 60s, but really 1970 is when the first San Diego started. Maybe that you might mark that as the demarcation point of true hardcore convention fandom.
Okay.
But I imagine, like you said, you know, the 12 and 13-year-olds who were reading comics in the 70s are now in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So, like you said, they're getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And so at conventions, the really hardcore fans, the heads, the true heads, and probably a lot of professional artists were trading and buying French albums.
Right.
Italian comics.
Right.
Spanish comics. And probably even manga. And so, like you said, American publishers like Marvel said, well, we want to dip our toes in this water and maybe create an additional market and be able to tell some stories that have a more mature
leaning to them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would probably have to have been what happened. But,
mm-hmm.
And so to me, like, I remember being on, you know, sitting in the aisles, you know, my mother go to the mall at Greenbrier and I go to B. Dalton bookstore.
Right. Nice.
Sit in the aisles and I would read the collections, art book collections, for Frazetta and Boris Vallejo and anybody else, Waylon, anybody else I could find.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in January when the calendars would come out, I would look at the calendars. And in some cases, I bought that stuff and I still have.
Right, me too. You know,
those original collections. But I think that's one of the things that Heavy Metal did and Epic Illustrated did is it closed the gap and married, you know, the science fiction and fantasy illustrated book covers that we all kind of loved.
Yeah.
With incredible comic book art.
Yeah. And I think, yeah. I think you go a step further, man, by, I think they actually made a brand new genre possible by doing so. I mean, look at, they once Epic Illustrated Magazine proper died, Epic, the imprint went on for a number of years afterwards. And I think the imprint of Epic actually made smaller companies which had creative individuals in their employ, it gave them opportunity to do different stories. I mean, it gave rise to Vertigo, it gave rise to Caliber, it gave rise to other aspects of storytelling.
That's very true.
You know, that weren't on the forefront of comics. You know,
so you probably see, like, okay, so heavy metal again still being published all through the 90s, 2000s, with et cetera.
Right.
But Epic ends in 1986, and then in the early 90s, we see the Peter Milligans, we see the Duncan Fragredos, we see the, you know, the Alan Moores and the Stephen Bissettes and Todd Albans and these folks who came up in the early roots of Vertigo. And you see, okay, what? Let's tell some freaky stories,
right?
You know, let's tell some weird shit. Let's just do some weird shit,
right?
You know, so yeah, you definitely do see that. Yeah, I agree with you, man.
Yeah, man.
And to some extent, for me. You know, at the time, you know, I was kind of a naive comics fan and a wannabe, you know, comic artist. I saw those magazines as like a graduation from comics.
Okay. Interesting.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And it wasn't true, but, you know, in my head, you know, I'm thinking, oh, okay, you know, you start out doing mainstream comics or whatever, and then you get to do painted comics.
Okay.
And then, you know, and that sort of thing. Like, I saw it as that for some reason. I don't know why that struck me. In any particular way, but it kind of did. I mean, did you think that at all, or did you just think?
I did actually. As far as you say it that way and phrase it that manner, I didn't quite like phrase it in that way. But I did see it as definitely a sign of maturity, which can be, I guess, put together with Graduation. I did see it as, okay, you still always keep your stalwarts in place. Like, it was always going to be X-Men for me. It was always going to be Fantastic Four for me. And various other comics like that, you know? But, you know, and Avengers. But, you know, as I got older, my taste changed and expanded to, okay, I like to see a little grit and grime. I like to see a little crime story going on here. I like to see a little crazy, questionable, spiritual thing going on here. I like to see some things which I hadn't seen before. And I wanted to see more painterly things expressed in a panel format. And when I saw Kent Williams, Briar Rose, dude, I swear to God, man.
Woo! Dog! Woo!
Man, bruh, I still to this day, I close my eyes and I see that, and I see that picture of I guess was the prince, and that deep shadow of his eyes, dude, and it's just like it still blows me away to this day, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
When I see obviously I'm very very. Back going back to heavy metal, I'm subjected to Serpieri's Morbius Gravis story. You know, it's more than just the overall erotic appeal to it, dude. It's the bleakness of it. It's the overall ineptitude of the main character. It's like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. That's what she was doing. You know,
yeah.
When she closed her eyes and would dream, it'd be the same shit she would dream, and she'd end up in the same situation again, and trying to figure out how to get out of it. You know, and it was about relationships too. It was weird because Shastar, her questionable human, organic monster lover, you know, it was a lesson for me. It's like sometimes you can't carry a torch for somebody that's going to kill you. You know, you can't.
Yeah.
It's
not advised.
It's not advised. You can't constantly try to go back and rescue people. Some people can't be rescued. Some people you have to let go and cut off.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was also a question of like, okay, how bad were the drugs that she was taking, or what kind of pawn was she inside of a bigger, you know, escapade and just being part of the scenery and being mashed into this ideal that wasn't really hers in the first place. You know.
Yeah.
So man. So, you know.
You know, it's funny you were mentioning that. This is a slight tangent, but do you remember John Byrne's, that sketchbook that he put out?
Yeah. Are you kidding? I have that.
Okay. I had it for a while, too, and I don't have it any longer. But I remember getting that, and that story that he had in there, and I don't think it had any dialogue in it. It was about, like, an astronaut who lands and...
Right.
He meets the woman and he like has a relationship with her, impregnates her, and then kind of becomes like a caveman living on this planet or whatever.
Right.
That always struck me as I was like, that seemed like some shit that should be in heavy metal. You
yes.
Know?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's the thing about it, man. I mean, yeah, it was perfect for heavy metal. I don't remember the title of it. Did you even have a title? Yeah, it did.
And of course, in the book, he had, you know, drawings of the Fantastic Four and.
Right,
you know, X-Men and Raj 2000 and Iron Fist and all that kind of stuff. But at least I believe he did. But
yeah, I think he did have a title. I think it was like Eclipse or something like that. But it was weird because it was written in like this really. Basically, what he did, from what I can tell, is he took a static font and he cut it with in different sections and then put it back together and pieced it together to make this interesting title. But yeah, man, it was a good story, man. You're right. It would have fit perfectly inside heavy metal. I mean,
yeah,
or epic for that matter. Either one of those.
Yeah.
Versus the Last Galactus story. You know, I mean, and don't get me wrong. I don't mean to rub it in, but it was brilliantly colored. It wasn't Byrne at his finest. You could tell he was kind of phoning it in to me.
Okay. You know?
So.
All right. Hey, man. Keep it 100. some other publications that were out around that time that I remember having adult themes, in some cases straight up adult themes.
Mm-hmm.
But Bizarre Adventures.
Yeah.
And Ooh. Penthouse Comics.
Man, hold on. When you say Bizarre Adventures, you can't gloss over, man, that awesome, beautiful, friggin' Paul Galassi cover of the X-Men, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about. Of course. That's the one I'm thinking about.
Sir, with that fully realized the Kurt Wagner Nightcrawler, yo.
Yeah.
Sir.
Yeah. He killed it, man.
He really did, man.
He killed it. But also like Penthouse Comics, remember that?
Oh yeah. The comic's so good you had to use both hands? Yeah.
Yeah. I do not remember that. Was that the tagline?
That was one of the taglines that was going around, dude. I don't know if it was.
Oh my gosh.
You know.
I do not remember that.
Yeah. What a horrible tagline.
And a forerunner to Epic and Heavy Metal, and you may not remember this, but Mike Friedrich's Star Reach magazine?
I do, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was,
and if I'm not mistaken, that was the first appearance of Howard Chaykin's Cody Starbuck.
Okay,
which was one of the reasons, you know, why I purchased it. But
yeah, man, and Cody Starbuck was awesome, dude. I guess I saw the reprints then of what that was in Epic, right?
Maybe so. I can't recall, but maybe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, man.
And I know Chaykin did like a fully painted Cody Starbuck graphic novel later.
Okay.
I forgot the publisher, but I still have it, and it's still wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And especially wonderful when I found out, you know, years and years later that he's partially colorblind. So,
right.
You know, there are certain hues that he has difficulty with. But, dude, when I was thumbing through the issues, and you mentioned this either when we were talking earlier today,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe somewhat just off mic before we started recording, but
mm-hmm.
Thumbing through there and looking at the credits. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the kinds of storytelling that you saw in Heavy Metal being more focused, or I forgot exactly what the point you were making.
Yeah.
Epic Illustrated, you know, coming from American Comics,
mm-hmm.
would oftentimes have a writer and an artist working on the story. But Heavy Metal would have a single person, most mm-hmm. often.
Doing it all, sir.
Writing the story, doing it all. And so there was more of a... probably a singular vision there at work.
Yeah, yeah. As Pascal Campion so appropriately said.
Yes,
said
it was, I had that in my notes to mention Pascal. Go ahead, dog.
Yeah. More of an Artur way of doing things, man. You know, and Adrian would say it too, man. It's a thing where it comes from a very personal space. You know, to that point, you're getting more of a, I think of a real. I won't say valid vision, but more of a personal and deeper vision than it, when you parse it out to, okay, you're the writer and I want you to draw this, you know,
right.
Nothing wrong with that. That combo's worked well for years and it still works well to this day. You know, the division of labor works well, but at the same time, you know, I think, and it's just me being an artist and being an art writer and so on and so forth. I think everybody that's an artist and a writer should tell their own personal story and own vision at some point.
Yeah.
Because you're doing yourself an honest favor. And I think your other work will be affected by it in a positive manner by being able to elucidate your own vision.
Yeah.
You know, so why not do it, you know?
I agree with you. I agree with you, man. And I do think it is very auteurist for them to have handled it that way. And probably, I can't recall what the publishing schedules were, but, you know, again, Epic coming from American Comics, you know, may have been more beholden to the 30-day production cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Or bi-monthly production cycle, mm-hmm. whereas Heavy Metal, you know, at some point they started for the first few years, maybe 9 years, I think they were monthly, and then they went to like quarterly, and then went to bi-monthly, and
oh yeah, they were all over the schedule, man.
yeah. So if you have 3 months to do something and you're doing all of the chores, that does afford you more time to do it. Now, you know,
right?
Artists and creative people being what they are, you know, they're still going to, you know, drag their ass. So
agreed, man. And you know, the thing about it, Swain, too, man, that I liked about it, they were unapologetic about the way they handled the magazine.
Yes.
Like, you know, Heavy Metal was like, okay, you know, it's going to go to, I'm sorry, but we were bi-monthly. We're going back to quarterly now. you know, we got enough in the backlog now. So now we go back to monthly again. You know,
yeah,
and there was no there may be some
no apologies or hand wringing. It's just, this is what it is,
right? This is what it is. You know, you take it or leave it. You know, and obviously it's a model that worked well for them, because every time they put something out, there was at least out of the 6 stories in the anthology, maybe sometimes 10 stories inside the anthology you would find on a regular basis. You know, there were at least 2 or 3 you can glom onto that you enjoyed out of each one. So it made the cost of the magazine like worth it to you at the end of the result.
Definitely, definitely.
So, and you can't say that about a lot of different comics, man. But now in this age of daisy chain letters and tweets and things like that, you know, where you know everything is digital, you know, that wouldn't fly, you know.
Yeah.
At all. So, you know, I think we've kind of gotten somewhat spoiled, just in some regard. I mean, sometimes waiting for something is a good thing. Sometimes, you know, sitting down and watching the entire 10 episodes in one, you know, long binge is a good thing. You know, it gives things room to breathe, you know?
I agree. You know, the idea of reading something or absorbing something and sitting with it for a minute,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, and, you know, cogitating, you know, what it is that you saw or read or experienced
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as a story. So, 4 years after Heavy Metal launched in 1977, a Heavy Metal movie hit the theaters in 1981.
Yes, it did.
Directed by Gerald Potterton, and it was produced by Ivan Reitman.
Okay, wow. Of Ghostbusters fame, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's a big Hollywood producer and director himself.
Right.
It was an animated movie. The movie star mm-hmm. John Candy, voice mm-hmm. talent. John Candy, Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, Harold Ramis. All these Chicago Canadian, you know,
right.
Second City people, it seems.
Exactly.
maybe they got them cheap. I don't know.
But, I'm sure they did, man. You know,
The movie leaned hard on concepts by Dan O'Bannon,
mm-hmm.
And Richard Corbin and Bernie
mm-hmm.
Wrightson.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack to the movie was a lot of what we would call today classic rockers. You know, Donald Fagen and Stevie Nicks and Devo. Sammy Hagar, Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
And Journey's Open Arms.
What, was Open Arms in there?
Yes.
I guess it was in the den sequence, right?
I believe so, yeah.
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 They shut that down real quick, though. It didn't last very long.
Yeah.
They probably didn't pay for it.
Well, I was just going to ask, did you see it in the theaters, man?
I think I did. I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theaters, in an art house theater. Like one of those weird theaters over by... off of Peachtree or something, dude. I don't recall.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah.
What did you think when you saw it, man?
Mixed emotions. I mean, I was glad to be in a situation where I was watching a movie rather. I don't recall, man. I'm confused because I think before we got on the mic, I think I said I didn't see it until I saw it on videotape. I'm pretty sure at some point I saw it in an actual movie theater. And because I recall that, like, being, you know, the audio being something that was very immersive and really liking it. Like that first opening sequence where the, Sammy Hagar song plays, and that the Corvette that comes out of the space shuttle and does that whole crazy reentry. And then it was impossible. It was gorgeous though. All that rotoscoping they did. But yeah, I saw it, man. And, I'd say upon reflection, some of the sequences are better than others as far as artistic interpretation of the original art goes, you know. Mm-hmm. there was a obvious difference in technology then than we have now to make things be more on point and authentic and true to the original art. So that disparity was very evident to me, especially in Den more than others. But my favorite sequence of all of them was two of them I liked a lot. One for being cartoony, one for being rotoscoped. The one for being cartoony was the one with the robot and Roberta. I can't think of the name of the sequence.
Right.
That was really cool to me because they captured things quite lovely for Roberta. But my favorite sequence was the Tarna sequence, where it was rotoscope. But rotoscoping, everybody knows what that is. It's basically they trace the actual video of the image that's been pre-recorded by an actual live actor and paint over it and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was done so artfully, man, and the story was a gentle story. It was, you know, a woman that was gearing up to kick some ass, you know.
Yeah,
and that she did, you know. And the through line for all these, the entire storyline, was this thing called a Lochnar, which was this,
right, exactly.
This evil orb that came down and tempted man to do things that it I guess he was going to do anyway, but gave him the power to kind of accomplish it and be a conqueror for a while. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that was her destiny, was to be a protector from the, I guess, of the earth from the Lochnar or whatever. But it was good, man. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Even some of the offhanded ones, like the Harry Cannon. Or was it the Harry Cannon?
Harry Canyon.
Canyon, the taxi driver?
That sounds like a porno name, yo, Harry Cannon.
Wow. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Which is kind of in keeping for heavy metal.
Heavy metal, yeah.
You know? But yeah, go ahead and tell me what you thought about.
I saw it in the theaters with a friend. I can't remember who it was. And I remember it was like just being blown away. Not in a, like it was good, but just blown away by it. We're like, wow.
Right.
I just saw this dude's dick in a cartoon. Oh. You know, yeah. And then like, wow. You know, the Harry Canyon sequence, which is the one that stayed with me the longest, where it was like, you know, because it was kind of like a Philip Marlowe detective story. This guy's driving was he driving a cab?
He was driving a cab. He was a cab driver.
Yeah, he was a cab driver. And yeah. He had that pedal he could flip up and vaporize people if they fucked with him in the back seat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then he meets this woman, and of course, you know, things go wrong, as they do.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, are those her titties?
Right, right.
Oh my God, is he?
Yeah, yeah.
Is he having sex with her?
Right.
And then of course, you know, she double crosses him in the end, and he vaporizes her, and he just kind of moves on. But
right.
Harry Canyon made an impression on me. Captain Stern did, because I think I was a fan of Bernie Wrightson at the time.
Oh, but of course we were. Yeah.
Well, this was 1981, so this was early for me.
Yeah.
But I was aware of Wrightson, and then of course the Tarna, the Tarna sequence, like you said, was really interesting. But I remember hating the music.
Yeah.
Because at the time I hated Journey. I hated Sammy Hagar. I liked Devo.
Devo rocked it, man.
But I just remember hating the music. I was like, oh, this fucking rock shit.
Right.
You know, because that was 81, so I was listening to more like R&B and soul.
Okay.
And rap was maybe start. When did Rapper's Delight come out?
Oh, man. But no, Rapper's Delight came out in 79, but it had made it 79. Into the mainstream yet in terms of being on, you know. So, I mean.
On the radio or anything like that.
Yeah. So it definitely didn't make it into movies.
Yeah. And at that time, my tastes were more like the European pop synth bands during that period,
right?
And like the Police, you know, that's more what I was into.
Yeah,
you
know? I would rather have heard you know, something from the Police or even from Adam and the Ants versus these mainstream rocker dudes, man. It's like,
yeah.
Like, so I don't know who's in charge of audio or in terms of audio mixing, but I mean, apparently it did well. It sold well. Their album probably, you know, sold gold or whatever the case may be. But you know,
yeah.
It wasn't our taste, our wheelhouse. We wanted to hear. Like, I want to see some authentic. Like, to me, the one of the biggest things I like explaining about heavy metal is heavy metal always seemed punk. It was always a punk thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And
subversive and transgressive.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and on the cutting edge, and they pushed that a great deal inside the pages. Even some of the people they had dressed in and some of the gear that they wore were that. But you saw none of that. You heard none of that in the music. The music was just like, oh, okay, this is okay.
Yeah,
passable.
I mean, maybe they were just trying to sell a soundtrack. I mean, that was a very 80s centric soundtrack
right.
That they had put together for. So maybe they were trying. They didn't actually think of, okay, if you actually choose music and songs that buttress the scene and
right.
and drive the narrative, it actually helps the movie.
Right.
So, yeah. But I don't remember feeling anything watching the movie. I just remember like, okay, it's over and it was an experience and that was kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, you know, I do remember like it was cool to see that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Be brought to the big screen because I don't think I had really seen it before. And this is, you know, years before, like, you know, certainly like the Batman movies.
And, oh, for sure.
You know, or Who Framed Roger Rabbit or, you know, anything that might be remotely considered similar.
Right.
Similar to it. But other movies that came out in 1981, just to kind of give people a sense of the landscape. Excalibur.
Okay.
Stripes. Time Bandits. Escape from New York.
Wow, okay.
Scanners, The Howling.
Wow.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Wow.
Blowout, Taps, Mad Max 2 came out in 1981.
Damn, okay.
And Dragon Slayer came out that year.
Okay.
Yeah. With that sweet ass Jeff Jones poster. God yes. damn it.
Yeah, yeah. Woo! Yeah, yeah.
Sir, that's my shit. I was going to mention that too earlier. Jeff Jones, who I think I had already become a fan of when I started reading heavy metal,
mm-hmm.
had a monthly or bi-monthly, whatever it was, cartoon called I'm Age.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a black and white pen and ink brush thing that he would do.
And that was in heavy metal.
That was in heavy metal, yeah. yeah. And the main character was eternally pregnant.
Right. Is that what her deal was?
Yeah, she was always pregnant. She never gave birth, but she would be, you know, okay. always spout these philosophies, and she'd be, you know, be very existential and soul searching. But she was always pregnant. She never gave birth.
Right. Wow. Okay, I didn't realize that. I think I can look at those again, man. Because I found it to be kind of morose and depressing, dude. She's like walking around with her head down and shit. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, it's Jeff Jones, so.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was all of his stuff was that way.
Right, even
his paintings and stuff, you know, as grand and as beautiful and as evocative as some of them were, you know.
Yeah, man.
They're just, none of the characters seemed happy.
Yeah.
You know, they just seemed, you know, I'm here. You know?
Right. That's interesting you say that too, man, because, you know, as we think about Jeffrey Catherine Jones, man, how majestic his work was, man, and how deep it was, you know, they knew that they had to, like, editorials, like, okay, I'm thinking of editorial for Epic, because I imagine they had these great expectations and stuff for how well the magazine was going to do, and it probably didn't do as well as they thought it was going to do as far as anthologies go. And you know, they were like, okay, it's the cover artist. It's the cover, I tell you. It's the cover. You know, you hear the board meetings, right? It's the cover that's selling. It's like, who's the hardest, you know, our best cover ever. Our first episode, magazine sold so well. It had fucking Frank Fazetta on there with the Seven Romans. We need some guys like that caliber. So they got, I think the next cover they got, or maybe, no, actually, it was number 25, issue number 25 of Epic Magazine. They got Jeff Jones to do a cover.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure if it was the original cover. I think it was probably one of his already, you know, painted masterpieces that they used for the cover, because it did a lot of that too. A lot of our boys from the studio. Yeah, mm-hmm. man. Mike Kaluta, yo. Woo.
Yeah. He had great covers for Epic.
Woo.
And there's one that they did. It was a Barry Windsor-Smith cover. I have it downstairs. Woo. With like a fairy with these huge majestic wings, but the fairy's like sinking in a pond, and there are lily pads all around.
Yes, yo.
And like strings and vines around it. Oh, it's fantastic.
All of that, man.
Absolutely fucking fantastic.
But my point was that they saw that their sales weren't where they wanted to be, and so they had to get some of the hottest fantasy artists out there that day to try to drive sales and bring them in, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to take a picture or do a scan of it and maybe post it with as part of either on the YouTube channel or try to use it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the covers I have downstairs is a picture of a nude woman,
mm-hmm.
and she's got a mask or something on, I think. Mm-hmm. And there's a robot behind her who has six arms.
Oh.
And his arms are the top set of arms are covering her eyes.
Okay.
The bottom set is covering her breasts, and then the bottom section is covering her groin area.
Right. Pelvic region.
And the hands of the robot covering her boobs predates Janet Jackson, that Janet Jackson album cover.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or that magazine cover.
Okay.
By years and years, maybe 10 years.
Wow.
So, and it's exactly that. It's, you know, oh, you can almost see the boobs, but you can't see the boobs. You can see nice. The part of the boobs. You see some side boob, but you're not going to get any nipple. You know, it's like, but it was really something. And that was the first thing I thought was, well, wow, this actually predates the Janet Jackson thing that was such a big deal.
Wow.
You know, when they shot it all those years ago. I think it was for Rolling Stone, either Rolling Stone or Vibe or something, but.
Wow. So again, I mean, so you're wondering how much of an influence that actually had on that photographer and the person that did the shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, I guess I can't imagine that they'd be like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but.
Right.
Of
course.
But did you know, sir? And I did some searching. I saw this on Wikipedia, and then I did some searching online to see if it was true. Around 2008, 2009. There were rumors that David Fincher and James Cameron were going to executive produce and each direct two episodes of 8 to 9 segments of a new animated heavy metal feature feature film.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And Kevin Eastman was going to be involved. He was going to direct. They were also going to involve Tim Miller, Gore Verbinski, Guillermo del Toro, and Zack Snyder. Wah, wah.
Right.
But anyway, the whole, you know, Fincher Cameron proposed heavy metal movie, it fell apart like a year later. And then I think even Robert Rodriguez announced at Comic-Con one year that he was going to do a heavy metal movie and that he had acquired the rights to it. So I don't know where any of that, you know, where any of that stands. Cause this, you know, I think that was like a decade ago. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know what? I mean, I think they try to do a couple things on network television too, like Sci-Fi Channel. They had gotten some kind of crazy, seemed like some kind of, Drulé, Inky Bilal, like comic turned into a movie, and it had like a head of all people had like one of the Wu-Tang Clan dudes in it, dude. It was like RZA or Jizza, you know, the one that was in the martial arts movie and whatnot. What, was that RZA? That was the RZA.
It was RZA, yeah.
Yeah, it was RZA. He was in it as a pilot, whatever the case may be, and it was weird, man. But you know, my thing now is I was actually texting Adrian before this, as we're talking about various things gearing up for the show. That he's like, do you think it still would work today? As far as would a heavy metal anthology, does it work today in today's market? And would Epic still be a valid thing in today's market? And you know, all the facts lean towards no, based on the fact that you know people don't really buy into anthologies that well. But I said in a circuitous manner, you could start by doing it as a television show, like for Netflix or for Amazon or whatever, let people catch the vapors from that. And then on the back end, as people are requesting to see more things about it, maybe you could build a couple of comics that will work on it. You know, it's like, I guess the now, poo-poo Cyberpunk 2077, which people are really, really just like lambasting for being an incomplete video game, due to the fault of their own and various other things of that nature, production schedules, all that crap. There's comics that are coming out too, based on some of the characters inside of the game. So,
okay,
there's just one more way to get people interested in comics, is I guess would be the way I'm hitting at. So, I think it will work, man. I mean, what do you think, man? Do you think that heavy metal would? I mean, it's still there now. Actually, they got a different bridge point now. You've seen their imprint, Virus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, you're already that kind of company anyway, so why do you need an imprint to, I guess, to do, I don't know, more individualized tales? It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get it, you know? So, I don't know.
I don't know, man. I mean, to do something more high concept that takes longer and you have to pour more into the storytelling and, you know, the words and the art,
mm-hmm.
which makes it more expensive. I don't know if there is enough of a readership out there in terms of dollars to support it.
Right.
I mean, you could do it as a companion piece to like a TV show or whatever, but I almost think with things like Black Mirror and, you know, with, you know, shows like Altered Carbon, which I think was recently canceled, Devs and Mr. Robot and some of the sci-fi that we see on TV and on Netflix and on other streaming platforms,
mm-hmm.
I almost think it would be better served to do it in that format,
right,
as opposed to doing it as a hard copy or a floppy,
yeah,
if you will, because it seems like, you know, and like even like some of the shorts that our former guest Robert Valley uh-huh. would do.
Right.
Those seem like things that we would have seen years ago and be a part of a heavy metal movie or be featured in the pages of Heavy Metal or Epic Illustrated in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think, interestingly enough, as you say that, man, I'm thinking about Netflix is a series that featured a Robert Valley short called Red Hot and...
Love and Robots.
Love, Death, and Robots. Yeah, Love, Death, and Robots.
Yeah,
man. And I think that
and
would
I think
be...
Fincher. I think Fincher was a part of that.
I won't be surprised. I think he did direct a feature, one of those features in there, man. And those things were gorgeous, man. I mean, they were like 15 minutes long and chock full of story.
Yeah.
And they're one and done, man. They got it done. So that was an anthology of sorts. I mean,
yeah.
I think if you can take that same kind of focus, that same kind of energy, and put it into a comic, you know, it's just weird, man, right now in terms of comics, man. You know, I don't want to poo-poo them. I enjoy them still, you know, for a lot of various reasons. I want them to see them succeed and things of that nature. But they really are a feeder, man. They really are a feeder to other industries and their successes, man. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, yeah. If they do more heavy metal in any form, especially if it's animated or, you know, as a feature or as, you know, as a TV show.
Right.
Yeah, they got to have to up their game on that soundtrack, dog. Oh, for sure.
For sure. I mean, that's without saying, man.
That concludes this episode of Sidebar Forever, hosted by Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson. You can find us online at sidebarforever.com. Any emails or questions can be directed to us at sidebarforever@gmail.com. And also, subscribe to us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Sidebar Forever is copyright 2020. Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson.